The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Hello and welcome to 2016 and to a special day after New Year's Day Zero Squared podcast. I'm Douglas Lane, the host of Zero Squared and the publisher of Zero Books. In this episode, there's a collage. The collage starts out with the voice of KMO from the C-Rome podcast, and he's in conversation with Alfie Bown, author of Enjoying It, Candy Crush and Capitalism. KMO describes to Alfie just how much he dislikes critical theory.
When they opened their mouths, I hadn't a clue as to what they were saying and what it possibly could have to do with the topic of digital labor. And since then, I've come to learn that what these people were doing was engaging in critical theory. And I've come to be sensitive to certain cues. Like, I can go 6 months or a year or more and never have opportunity to use the word problematic just organically in a sentence. But I get into these situations where people are using it 3 times in 5 minutes. And if I hear somebody use the word imaginary as a noun, I'm suddenly on guard. It's like, uh-oh, I think this person is about to start wasting my time in a massive way. What is going on?
All the paintings of the tradition used the convention of perspective, which is unique to European art. Now, perspective centers everything on the eye of the beholder. It is like a beam from a lighthouse, only instead of light traveling outwards, appearances travel in. And our tradition of art called those appearances reality. Perspective makes the eye the center of the visible world. But the human eye can only be in one place at a time. It takes its visible world with it as it walks.
Today, we will look at some paradoxes about perception, known as arguments from illusion. These arguments ask us to consider cases of non-veridical perception, where something appears different than it is. For example, when we look at round coins sideways, they appear elliptical. Similarly, when seen from a greater distance, a man may seem less than half as tall as another man of roughly equal height. Or consider the phenomenon known as refraction. When a straight straw is partially immersed in water, it looks bent. All of these facts are familiar from daily life. None of them is normally contested. But these familiar facts seem to have a striking consequence. They seem to imply that we are cut off from the physical objects around us by a veil of experience within us. The 18th century philosopher David Hume drew this consequence very swiftly when reflecting on another relevant fact. As we all know, a table looks smaller and smaller to people the further away they move from it. Hume observes that the table we see seems to get smaller as we move away from it. Yet there is no change in the size of the real table, which is made of wood and stands in the parlor, regardless of whether we look at it or not. Hume immediately infers that we cannot be aware of this unchanging real table, and therefore must be aware of something else. He concludes that the thing we see is an image of the table, whose size does change as we move away from the table. This image then is present to us in our minds. In other words, when you look at the table, you are only aware of a mental image, not of the physical table. Sense data are subjective, ever-changing, and fleeting, like the flickering of a candle or its dying smoke.
What's problematic in today's critical theory? That is, what is it that motivates the critical theorist to call something problematic? According to the Philosophy Dictionary Online, that's www.philosophydictionary.org, something is a problematic judgment when it involves the consciousness of the mere possibility, or when it does not contain the consciousness of actuality or necessity. To clarify, something is problematic or problematic judgment when it is subjective. In Hegel's Science of Logic, he labels a problematic as assertoric. This just means that it is an assertion given by a particular subject. To make this clearer still, something is problematic or problematized when it can be seen to be self-generated and thereby self-interested rather than objective or necessary. Again, the problem in the term problematic is the subjectivity of experience. A claim is problematic when its relationship to a universal notion or an objective fact has not been determined. We might wonder then why it is that so many people use the term problematic a bit differently.
So, you're a feminist now, and it's about to get problematic up in here. What's up, everyone? Lacey Green here. Last week I checked out the VMAs, and well, it was definitely a new experience for me. I saw a lot of celebrities, aka very problematic people. Miley Cyrus was wearing dreadlocks. Taylor Swift preaches a feminism that's far from intersectional. The Weeknd calls women bitches and hoes. What's a girl to do at the VMAs? A lot of people in the anti-feminist camp tell me that they find the problematic analysis a big turnoff. Feminists and non-feminists alike have told me that they feel like they're not allowed to enjoy anything anymore. Okay, we need to talk about that. When feminists say something's problematic, they're usually referring to words, behaviors, ideas.
Hello, awesome people. I was gonna make a video about my gender identity today, but something else has been getting to me, and I think it's more important. Your fave is problematic. If you're a Tumblr user like I am, you've probably heard this phrase. And if you're in my corner of Tumblr, you probably heard a few people take some digs at young adult novelist and YouTube star John Green. A quick Google search will reveal to you that primary complaints of John Green's problematicness include that he once joked about nerd girls being an underutilized romantic resource, that he is shamed
thin women. Hi there,
women,
so I've got some bad news. I'm problematic. But I feel like everybody is in some way. Saying you're not problematic is like saying you're perfect and have absolutely no room for improvement, which is definitely not the case for me. I could work on a lot. You see, the other day, this post popped up on my Tumblr that was like, your fave is unproblematic, Evan Edinger, and went on to describe how I'm basically perfect, outlining all the good things I've done in the past.
The word problematic has become synonymous with immoral and oppressive, because, to put it very simply, Kant's solution to the problem in problematic, that is, the subjectivity or idealism involved in all thinking, and thereby in all forms of knowledge, has been, rightly or wrongly, found wanting. While Kant aimed at holding on to rationality and truth by finding subjective universals or synthetic a priori categories and judgments, this subjective rationality has, for the most part, been picked apart. Most have sided with Nietzsche as against Kant. That is, most people, especially critical theorists, are very suspicious of any claim to universality. The ideas of the philosopher Foucault, for instance, are an example of this rejection of Kant's subjective rationality.
Along with Roland Barthes and Jacques Derrida, Michel Foucault is usually linked with a post-war generation of French thinkers whose ideas about language helped shape our understanding of the postmodern world.
Le comportement criminel, le comportement de délinquance, la transgression des lois sont des comportements en eux-mêmes trop complexes, dont on connaît trop mal les déterminations.
Foucault, however, was unique. He went beyond language to examine the nature of society itself, the nature of man. He was interested in what lay beyond what we accept as normal and natural, and the way transgression and deviancy can take us there. Furthermore, as no fewer than three biographies published in English this year have revealed, Foucault's interest in such themes was more than merely academic. One book, in particular, has aroused controversy for dwelling on how Foucault himself transgressed, how his life became a deeply personal quest into a world beyond good and evil.
Foucault was preoccupied with exploring states that were beyond normal everyday experience. Drugs was one such realm of experience. Certain forms of eroticism would create unusual sensations, and that it was important for him as a way of reconfiguring and reimagining the world and his place in the world.
Eroticism, drugs, the realm beyond normal experience. These are unusual themes for a modern philosopher. In the first few decades of this century, academic philosophy more or less abandoned trying to tackle issues that dealt with life and how it should be lived, preferring instead to concentrate on the more analytical business of linguistics and logic.
Since that time, the important questions about what it means to be a human being have taken place in other activities: art, politics, literature, social sciences. Michel Foucault is one of those rare people who was able to take the really, truly important questions about what it means to be a human being in the 20th century and to go out into the world and examine in detail aspects of our daily life, from the way we make our bodies, to the way we make our lives, to the way we govern each other, to the way we fight, to the way we fuck, to the way we do everything, and re-raise those questions in a way that makes us pause and stop and think about the kind of beings that we are and whether we want to be like that.
By digging through history, engaging in what he called an archaeology of knowledge, Foucault questioned fundamental assumptions about modern experience, the assumptions that form the basis of the distinction between good and bad, sanity and madness, normality and sexual deviancy.
Foucault is the great explorer of the perverse. Foucault takes the traditional victims of history, the mad, the perverts, the bad, the sinful, the criminal, etc., doesn't romanticize them. He avoids doing that.
But the continental tradition, or the realm of so-called critical theory, has rejected the Kantian solution to the problem of the problematic of subjectivity, rejected Kant's straightforward humanism, and for the most part has done this by attempting to put aside knowledge claims altogether. The trick has been to side with the objective. In political terms, this has meant siding with the marginal, the oppressed, the people left out of society with its various knowledge practices or discourses. On the other hand, the realm of analytic philosophy has embraced Kant.
My own view is that anarchism flows quite naturally out of major concerns of and commitments of the Enlightenment, which found an expression in classical liberalism. And classical liberalism essentially was destroyed by the rise of capitalism. It's inconsistent with it. But anarchism, I think, is the inheritor of the ideals that were developed in one or another form during the Enlightenment. Kant's expression is one example, exemplified in a particular way in classical liberal doctrine, wrecked on the shoals of capitalism, picked up by the libertarian left movements, which are the natural inheritors of them. So in that sense, yes, but it's broader.
Okay.
It's interesting that a major analytic figure like Chomsky has remained a Kantian idealist. He's a great proponent of scientific knowledge, while simultaneously holding that no understanding of objective reality is possible. In this way, Chomsky's understanding of science is problematic, wherein we can easily see that what he calls knowledge can't be demonstrated to be universal or true, but is rather purely subjective.
There was a concept of materialism right through the early scientific revolution, right through Newton. Newton still accepted it. In fact, the great scientists of the next century accepted it. You know, Lagrange, others kept trying to develop a material, mechanistic concept of the universe that went right through the 19th century, ether theories and so on. It was finally given up in the 20th century. You know, finally recognized, look, we're never going to get it. And totally different ways of looking at things were developed, which have no relation to traditional materialism. Friedrich Lange is correct. And nobody's ever suggested another notion. Materialism just is like anything we more or less understand. It includes thinking, it includes reasoning, and so on and so forth. Locke's suggestion. So we can't leave it behind unless someone tells it what it is. But there's no reason why we can't study it. I mean, we can study what the human capacity of understanding is. In fact, we know some things about it. We know some negative things. For example, we can't understand the way the world works because our concept of understanding is too limited to incorporate what Newton described as an absurdity. You know, people like Newton and Hume and Locke were not idiots. We have to take them seriously. They regarded it as an absurdity for very good reasons. And modern cognitive science, which somehow tries to recapitulate some of this, finds pretty much that. So, as I mentioned, an infant presented with presentations which indicate that there's some kind of causality, like, you know, when the ball rolls this way, light turns red or something, they will invent a mechanical cause. And they don't care if it's not visible, because infants understand that most of what goes on is invisible. You know, but there's got to be some mechanical cause, otherwise no way for it to influence anything else. So that does seem to be the way our minds work. And that tells us something about the limits of our understanding.
Two of us share something.
I don't understand physics either. So we're in the same boat. And in fact, I don't think physicists understand it, and they're pretty open about it. But see, you can't ask the question about interaction between physical and non-physical until you tell us what physical means. Okay, you've at least got to be able to tell us what physical means in order for the question to be answered. But there hasn't been any concept of physical for hundreds of years. There was one in the early scientific revolution, a very intuitive concept of the physical. That's what inspired Galileo, Descartes, Leibniz, Newton, Lagrange, you know, many others all throughout the modern history of science. But it's been recognized, but it was already recognized after Newton that it's gone. Like Locke recognized it, Hume recognized it. For Hume, it's not only gone, it's a total mystery beyond our intellectual capacities. And that we can speculate about, but it's certainly gone. And no one has proposed anything else. The physical these days are things that Newton would have regarded as total absurdities, like curved space-time. How can that be physical? Quantum entanglement. I mean, Einstein regarded that as non-physical because it's so absurd. But, you know, now scientists just accept it. Physical is just anything we more or less understand. And if that's the only notion of physical we have, there can't be interaction between physical and non-physical. Non-physical will be all the things, just all the things we don't understand. If we ever get to understand them, they'll be physical.
What has been lost then is, according to the analytic tradition, any notion of authenticity or reality, and on the continental side, any hope of a reasonable interpretive power or understanding. Neither approach can get us past the realm of classical liberalism, as the analytic tradition relies on this liberalism as the ever-so-modest foundation for its thought, while the continental approach has been trying to work without any foundation or thought, resorting instead to theories about affect, desires, and other mystifying powers.
Karl Marx, take one. Imperialism is the worst thing I've ever heard. Wait. Before we go on, a brief joke for any psychics in the audience. We know who we are, don't we?
Look, the fog's coming in now. No one's seen that movie, good.
We're all set. Time for some culture now. Some poetry to enlighten your brief day. Here it is, my first poem. Red sand between my toes, summer vacation in outer space. That was a Martian haiku. Now a simpler poem, a poem written on acid entitled Abir. Abir. Amilabar. Eve Arden. Bibir. Those of you who understood it went, wow, reality, what a concept.
What the analytic and the continental traditions share is an acceptance of the present, along with an assumption that what we common folk call reality is in fact just a shared fiction. The only point of disagreement is whether that fiction is, in some sense, rational. The difference, then, is that while the analytic philosophers are living inside naturalistic novels, the continental types are stuck, railing against the borders of novels written by authors like Philip K. Dick or Franz Kafka.
It may have had something to do with my writing, it may have had something to do with my lifestyle, or a combination of both, but I was too afraid of the police to ask what it was I was doing.
Dick's vision was formed by the changing landscape of California, a rural paradise that he saw bulldozed into urban submission. From a trash world ever more dependent on consumer disposables, Philip K. Dick created a fictional universe in which the line between human and machine becomes blurred. Your toaster might just have an opinion of its own. Your telephone might be plotting against you, and your video camera might be keeping an eye on you before filing its own report.